From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. Maryland lawmakers are bringing a wide range of problems and aspirations to the legislative session that starts Wednesday. They'll try to subdue the dire homicides in Baltimore and the escalating overdose deaths statewide. They plan to respond to hurdles from the Trump administration, like the new federal tax law that could shake up Maryland's revenues as well as undermine health insurance. Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green and Barry Raskovar, columnist for Political Maryland, agree the election year shapes every issue into a contest for political advantage between the Democratic majority and the Republican governor. Here's Raskovar.
This legislative session, I think you're going to see more of Larry Hogan maybe battling Democrats in the legislature to be a populist governor in the public's mind, but at the same time taking on Donald Trump.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. In 2 days, Wednesday at noon, the General Assembly will convene in Annapolis for its 438th session, 90 days of addressing the state's aspirations and troubles, the appalling pattern of homicides in Baltimore, the fragility of the health insurance market, the pressures on Maryland's tax revenues, the epidemic of deaths from opioids, the constraints on craft brewers, and myriad other issues. In an election year, every issue is an opportunity for the Democratic majority in the legislature to frame a political advantage over the Republican governor and vice versa. To help us understand the headlines that will sail past us for the next 3 months, we're joined by two close observers of the legislative scene in Annapolis. Longtime political commentator Barry Raskovar writes for the blog Political Maryland. Welcome back, Barry.
It's a pleasure to be back here, Sheila.
And Andy Green is the Baltimore Sun's opinion editor. Welcome back, Andy.
Great to see you, Sheila.
So we're expecting to see some of that political positioning right out of the box when the legislature votes on overriding Governor Larry Hogan's veto of a bill that would require businesses with at least 15 employees to let their workers earn at least 5 days of sick leave every year. In November, Governor Hogan proposed his own sick leave bill. Andy Green, you have editorialized about this. Substantively, what's the difference between their approaches?
The governor would like to have this kick in at a larger size of business, so more employees. He also would like to see the state provide some tax incentives for smaller businesses to provide these benefits.
Not small as the businesses that the Democrats bill
is aimed at. He would like to provide incentives for smaller companies, even smaller than the ones the Democrats would require, to voluntarily offer these benefits and require it at a higher level. He also has had some of his cabinet members spend some months studying this issue and has found some issues in the bill that are a little bit technical in some regards that he thinks could be made more business friendly without impacting workers too much. In some cases, arguably even benefiting workers more. For example, there's a big dispute between the legislature and the governor about whether victims of domestic abuse or stalking would be required to tell their employers about this when they take time off to, you know, go to court or whatever else they need to do to deal with that. The legislature insists no, they don't have to. The governor says yes, they would. This would be an invasion of privacy. Either way, we at the Sun editorial board like the governor's solution, which is to say, you can use these 5 days off for whatever you need to. You don't need to bring in a doctor's note. You don't need to explain, which is the way a lot of private sector employers are going these days anyway. However, in the politicized Annapolis, as you mentioned, with everything being a setup for the gubernatorial election, I would expect a very swift move to simply override the governor on this and move on to other issues.
Yes, this is a prime example of how politics is going to surmount maybe a better bill, that the Democrats are going to make sure that Governor Hogan gets no wins this coming session that he can use in the upcoming gubernatorial campaign. But it's going to be very, very tricky for the people on the second floor in the State House,
the governor's office.
To deal with this, because there are issues that such as health care, where you're going to have to do something, or there are going to be political consequences. So again, it all gets back to the politics in the fourth year of the governor's term. The legislators are up for re-election too. It's all politics for 90 days.
Well, this particular override vote, as I recall, the paid sick leave bill passed the Senate with just one vote more than they need to override
Correct.
A veto.
Yes.
So is there any suspense about whether the Democrats actually have the votes to override?
A little bit. The House seems completely solid on an override vote. As you say, it's closer in the Senate, but this is something Senate President Miller appears to want to do. As we know, when Senate President Miller wants a vote, he can usually find a way to get it.
And one of the people that is on a limb here is State Senator Jim Brochin from Baltimore County. Well, he's running for county executive. If he decides to be the maverick that he's proven to be in the past on this issue, it could hurt him in the primary.
To support the override.
To support the governor. To support the governor in this case.
Right, because he's finding himself in a position where he's previously been running in a very conservative district. Now he's running countywide. So the calculus for him, based on what he did last year, may be different from what he does now, that he's facing off against some more progressive candidates in the Baltimore County primary. So it'll be interesting to see whether where he lands on this. He's usually pretty politically adroit, so we'll see how that goes. But, in general, if I were laying money on it, I would lay money on a veto override and also on the legislature not acting on any of the governor's ideas on this, even if they are better. And, maybe we'll come back and come around to what he's proposing in a year or two as the implementation of this comes online.
That is Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Political Maryland columnist Barry Raskovar is here, too. We're looking ahead to the General Assembly session that starts on Wednesday. President Trump, the shadow of President Trump, is going to be everywhere this session. Barry, how will we see that?
Well, we're going to see it in two major areas. One is how the state of Maryland responds to the Trump Republican tax cut, which either advertently or inadvertently is going to raise state taxes for a lot of people in Maryland. How you make that disappear, how you erase that.
Let me just interrupt and ask you to clarify. The reason that the federal tax cut could result in a tax cut in Maryland is that the Maryland income tax system piggybacks.
It's coupled. And the term they use is they have to decouple elements of the Maryland code from the federal code in order to have a wash so that there are few people that get hurt.
Yeah, so the basic mechanism here that's a problem for a lot of Maryland taxpayers is Maryland is the number one state in the country for people itemizing their taxes. This is because we have relatively high property values, relatively high incomes on average, and relatively high state and local tax burdens. So one of the key elements of the federal tax bill is to limit your ability to deduct state and local taxes to a total of $10,000 between income and property taxes or sales taxes and property taxes, but in Maryland, it's income taxes are the issue. So what the federal policy is trying to do is to steer people into taking the standard deduction. The standard deduction has been roughly doubled. So for a lot of people, it's just going to make sense to take the standard federal deduction. They'll get a better deal in doing that. But in Maryland, the standard deduction is a tiny fraction of what the new federal one is. So you could wind up paying substantially more in state income taxes in order to save money on your federal taxes. Now, Governor Hogan came out and said, we're going to fix this. We don't think that the state should get an income tax windfall as a result of the federal tax bill, which he's quite right, would happen. And, you know, Democrats, I think, generally speaking, don't disagree with that. The question is how you go about making that work. You can't currently itemize your Maryland taxes if you take the standard deduction on your federal taxes. Some states do allow you to do that, but it's very complicated because, you know, suddenly the comptroller's office would have to police things that the IRS has done before and establish rules. There may be some other ways to get at this, but to achieve the goal of making this reform revenue neutral both for the state and for particular individuals would be a very complicated policy challenge.
And they have to do it.
Yeah.
They have to figure it out. Barry, you said there were two ways we're going to see
President
Trump. Yes,
the other one has to do with eliminating the health insurance mandate in the federal tax cut law. This means that the Obamacare program in Maryland is in grave jeopardy of collapsing within a year or two.
As is the case in other states as well.
Yes.
It's not unique to Maryland.
Yes. So what do you do about that? Well, we have a new health secretary in Maryland, Bobby Neal, who's a familiar face in Annapolis, extremely well-liked by Democrats, even though he's a conservative Republican, trusted by Governor Hogan. He is sort of the Mr. Fix-It and has been for a couple of decades in Annapolis when it comes to fiscal messes, but he's also a healthcare expert. He's got to figure this one out. And there is a plan floating around from CareFirst,
which is the biggest insurer by far.
It's lost $400 million since 2014 on these insurance plans in the individual market. It expects that in 2019 it could lose another $100 million, even if it raised premiums 50%. So they've come up with a proposal with a high deductible and a limit on how much you'd have to pay out of pocket before a state program would kick in and pay the rest of the bills.
But
right.
Let me make sure I'm understanding the most basic level here is that this you're talking about the legislature reasserting a mandate for health insurance in Maryland.
Right. So Massachusetts, which established an individual mandate before the ACA came along, has maintained its individual mandate under state law. It didn't get rid of it when Obamacare passed. And so they will still continue to enforce that now that the federal government isn't. Healthcare advocates in Maryland have been urging the same thing. That was also part of the CareFirst plan that Barry mentioned. So we could enact a law to essentially say that what penalties you would have paid to the federal government previously under the individual mandate, you now pay to the state, and whatever revenue we raise in that goes into funding this reinsurance program that Barry alluded to before, which helps even out some of the high cost patients from the system that are what's really driving the costs here. I mean, the problem that you have without the individual mandate is that older and sicker people are going to get insurance because they need it. Younger, healthier people are going to go without. And without the revenue from those younger, healthier people, rates for everyone go way up. So the part of dealing with that is the individual mandate. Part of dealing with that is a reinsurance system that some states have adopted that Maryland should certainly look into as well. But there are some other issues here, too, aside from those in the tax bill. President Trump has also said he's going to stop making cost-sharing reduction subsidy payments, which are what helps compensate for some other limits under the ACA for how much out-of-pocket expenses people can have. Insurance companies are now required to cover those costs, and the federal government has been reimbursing them for that, and President Trump has said we're going to stop doing that. That's part of what drove rates up even higher this fall. There has been some talk in the Senate of trying to restore those in some way, but the fate of that is entirely unclear. So there could very well be a debate in Annapolis about whether to do that on the state level as well.
There's some other health issues I want to ask you about. We need to take a quick break here. And when we come back, I also want to talk about what the legislature and the governor may do about the violence, the homicides in Baltimore. Political Maryland columnist Barry Raskovar and Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green are staying with us. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you will too.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Talking this morning about the Maryland legislative session that will start Wednesday with Barry Raskovar, who writes for the blog Political Maryland, and Andy Green, the Baltimore Sun's opinion editor. 343 people were murdered in Baltimore in 2017, almost 9 out of 10 of them shot. Governor Hogan and the legislature want to do something about this horrifying situation. What will they try, Andy?
There's a limit, of course, to what the state government can do. There will be a few things that they'll try. Governor Hogan has said he's going to push for a truth in sentencing law, which many other states have, that limits the ability of violent criminals to get out of prison early, whether for a good time or just general parole. He'll certainly push for that. We will see Mayor Catherine Pugh and Police Chief Kevin Davis come back again and try to enact tougher penalties for illegal handgun possession, which is an issue they've been pushing for several years. So far to no avail. We'll certainly see that. And there will also be a fight to try to get more funding for assistance to the city police department, which is pretty well undermanned these days. Also to support programs like Safe Streets that seek to interrupt violence on the community level.
And how does all that play out in an election year?
Well, that's a good question, because as I said earlier, the Democrats in the legislature are not going to allow the governor, the Republican governor, to have any major wins. And Hogan is, in a way, accommodating them on the crime issue, because what he's proposing is really a throwback to the O'Malley years. Let's get tough on these criminals. We've been there before. It hasn't worked. And I suspect that the legislature will not pay much attention to what the governor is proposing in that area. I think that they'll be more concerned with what Mayor Pugh proposes and whether or not they can fund it. That's a big problem, because they have budget woes in Annapolis, as has been the case for the last decade.
Budget woes beyond what the changes in the federal tax law may generate?
Oh, yes. They're still basically running at a deficit. Operating costs are much more than the revenue coming in.
On a substantive level, the politics of the Hogan-Pugh situation are problematic. The two of them have at times seemed pretty close, but recently have been a little strained on this issue. When Governor Hogan announced his crime plan, she didn't show up. She sort of dismissed what he was proposing as old news. And that's really a problem, because in order to have the most effective crime-fighting strategy we can, the state and local and city government and the federal partners too really need to be working hand in glove. And it's worrisome to see any kind of strain in that relationship.
Another issue that seems, at least to me, almost insolvable, but I presume the legislature will try in some way, is the opioid overdose epidemic. Are there proposals there that might make a difference?
Well, there will be proposals. Whether they'll make a difference is anyone's guess. I mean, this is something that they have been kicking around for several years. I think that one of the key questions is going to be, again, to do with the budget, how much funding can be afforded to drug treatment and prevention programs. There's simply no easy, quick fix on this one.
Right. It's a huge problem, and we're not sure what direction the governor or the legislature is going to press for. It could be more education. You got to get the word out that fentanyl, for instance, is something you don't go near because it's way too dangerous. You know, the word has not gotten to the addicts. And it's a tough one. It's a very tough one. But legislators and the governor in an election year will certainly try to come up with, quote, the solution, unquote.
That's political Maryland columnist Barry Raskovar here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. The Baltimore Sun's opinion editor, Andy Green, is here, too. We're highlighting some issues we expect the state legislature to deal with in its session that starts Wednesday. I hear that there is a beer war brewing.
Yes.
I'm not sure I quite understand what it is. Can one of you briefly
Sure.
explain it to me?
Last year, the legislature passed new rules for craft breweries in order to accommodate the Guinness tap room that is planned for the Arbutus Halethorpe area. That legislation that came out of it was pretty controversial. Prompted a big fight between our traditional elements of the industry, the retailers and the distributors, versus the newer entrants, the craft brewers. Comptroller Peter Franchot has become deeply, deeply involved in this issue. You see him going around the state hoisting pints of craft beer all the time with his arms around brewers. He convened a task force over the course of the interim to try to find new policies to encourage the craft beer industry. And he's come up with what he calls his 12-pack of reforms, which would undo some of the elements of the legislation last year that were, in fact, kind of ridiculous. You know, for example, that we allow these tap rooms to sell 2,000 barrels of beer. If they want, they can sell another 1,000, but they first have to put it on a truck, take it to a distributor, unload it in their warehouse, reload it on the truck, bring it back, and buy it from the distributor to sell their own beer. There are a few elements like that that clearly ought to be changed. However, this has become a highly politicized fight. Comptroller Franchot has had some very sharp words for his fellow Democrats in the General Assembly, essentially accusing them of being bought and paid for by the liquor industry. And this is a tough, tough issue to go after in general, because he is right. The liquor industry is very influential in Annapolis. And he has, I think, perhaps made the fight a little bit harder, although it is probably a winning political issue for him as he faces another reelection.
Yeah, and I think the Democratic leaders in the legislature see this as a reelection bid by Franchot, that he's going to use this to show that he's on the side of the beer drinker, the little guy.
It's a populist maverick move
yes,
for the
yes, comptroller. And he's going up against these old pals who are not going to change their ways. But I think what you're going to see is Franchot will get a hearing, and that will be the end of the bill.
So you're really painting a picture that you expect the Democratic majority to treat Comptroller Franchot the way you expect them to treat Republican Governor Hogan,
I think it's fair to say that Comptroller Franchot probably has fewer friends in the General Assembly than Governor Hogan does.
That's fodder for a whole nother conversation. In just the couple minutes we have left, I'd like to loop back to President Trump and his shadow on this legislature, in particular in terms of the environment. I understand Attorney General Frosch, who's an environmental advocate, is holding a hearing, I guess this week, to raise concerns about a Trump proposal on clean power plants. I mean, how do you see the environmental issues playing out?
Well, there will be a lot of focus on the state level about the state's renewable energy portfolio standards. There's a push to not only increase them, but also to perhaps take out some of the less clean elements of it, in particular trash incineration, which is a big issue in Baltimore. That's going to be a big focus. There's a great deal of concern about the degree to which the Trump administration will support the Chesapeake Bay cleanup, either monetarily or in terms of holding the state's feet to the fire for the Bay Pollution Diet. There are a lot of worries there, and also about the Trump administration's enforcement of clean air standards on upwind coal-fired power plants in other states that contribute to our poor air quality here. So those are some of the things that they'll be focused on.
But there's almost nothing a state legislature can do at this stage about these federal issues of being implemented by the Trump administration. But they will talk about it.
Yes. Attorney General Frosh Cannon is doing something in suing the federal government over this.
I think Governor Hogan asked
him
to do.
Yes, he did. He did, yes. Which is sort of a no-brainer. You're suing over power plants in other states.
Right. So. The governor is being a very slick politician because he's opposing Trump on a lot of these environmental issues as well as the health care issue.
He came out quickly against the Trump offshore drilling plan, for example, which is very smart for him to do and also the right thing to do.
Right. He's a Republican running in a Democratic state, and yet he retains his popularity. So he's got to keep doing that up through November. So this legislative session, I think you're going to see more of Larry Hogan maybe battling Democrats in the legislature to be a populist governor in the public's mind, but at the same time taking on Donald Trump. But he won't do it in ways that will antagonize his Republican base.
That's a narrow road to walk. I appreciate this conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Sheila.
It's a pleasure.
Andy Green organizes and edits the Baltimore Sun's opinion pages. Barry Raskovar blogs and writes a regular column at politicalmaryland.com. Tom Hall will have more about the legislative session tomorrow on Midday, including WIPR Statehouse reporter Rachel Bay. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back tomorrow morning. Hope you'll join us.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.